Dawn Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT and the free Odyssey app.
Dr. Stephen Quay, we're really honored to have you here this morning. Thanks for coming on and really making us aware of some of these important health and medical issues.
It's great to be with you, Dawn, this morning. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. I'll start with breast cancer. It runs in my family on my mom's side. My great-great-grandmother, survivor, my great-grandmother, my grandmother, who had a mastectomy, and my mom just had lumpectomies because of the awareness factor. And that's really the beginning, I think, in families to just talk about it, because a lot of families don't talk about the health history.
It is. It really is important. I mean, there's two things I want to emphasize. What you just said is, going back three or four or five generations, you can start to see patterns in your family. But when a woman gets breast cancer, only one out of 12 have a family history. The other 11, they're the first in their family. So this disease is really tricky.
Yeah, and with my grandmothers and even my mom, not big drinkers or drinkers at all. So as far as the alcohol study, that was surprising to me. I mean, not that, of course, everything in moderation, that's the old saying. But in this one, how concerned should individuals, I mean, should people just say, meh, it's not worth it? Why would I even have an occasional glass of wine?
Yeah, so it's complicated, and I think because it's so important as part of our social fabric, I think it's important to understand it. So alcohol does increase breast cancer about 10 to 15%, if whatever your background rate would be, but it also can help with heart disease, and of course, actually, cardiovascular disease kills more women than breast cancer does. So there is a balance there. This report was strictly on alcohol and cancer. If I had been writing it myself, I probably would have done what happened a few weeks earlier where the National Academy of Science did alcohol in all health. And that one said, yes, it's associated with increased cancer, but it's also associated with decreased cardiovascular disease to give you a more balanced picture. So it is complicated, but if we want to stick with just breast cancer, alcohol, two drinks a day is going to 100 women taking two drinks a day, four of them are going to have breast cancer that they wouldn't have had it in their lifetime if they had not gone. So it's 4 out of 100. That's your risk.
Yeah, and that's two drinks a day to me. That's not moderate. You know what I mean? Like two drinks a day, 7 days a week. That's a lot. That's not just, let's have a glass of wine on a Friday night, go out to dinner.
You're right. And of course, all the people that are writing these investigators are probably also social or some level of drinkers. So you have to, there's what's called a bias, an inherent bias in some of these studies.
That's well put. Dr. Quay, I should ask you about Atossa Therapeutics, globally recognized for revolutionizing breast cancer prevention. For those who have not heard of Atossa Therapeutics, am I pronouncing it correctly? Atossa?
Atossa. Oh, yeah, pretty close. Princess Atossa was the first woman with breast cancer in recorded history about 400 years before Christ, 400 BC. And her slave cauterizes. It didn't do very well, but we're honoring her and all the women since her who've had breast cancer.
I love it. And so that's, a therapeutics company that's recognized for, really, when you say revolutionizing breast cancer prevention, can you just give me an example of how Atossa has revolutionized? Mm-hmm.
So we're in the clinical trial phase, so we're not FDA approved. But so when a woman gets a mammogram, in the past they were looking for just one thing, and now they're looking for two things. In the past, they were looking for what are like little grains of salt, which are actually cancers that have died, and then you want to biopsy and go out. And so that's its primary purpose. But then over two or three decades, we realized that the background whiteness of the breast, called the density, so a very fatty breast is black on an x-ray, and then a very fibrous breast is white. So there's a gradation. And there were 5 to 8 times more cancer, so 500 to 800% more cancers in the dense breasts than in the not dense breasts. So I invented a drug that actually lowers the density, and we reported at a major meeting in December. With just a drug that has the same side effects as a sugar pill in the clinical trials, we were able to lower density at a level that in the past has reduced about half of breast cancers. So my vision for the future, FDA approval and additional work, is a woman doesn't think about her breast health until she's 40. She gets a mammogram. She doesn't have cancer, which is good news. She has high density, which is a little troublesome. So she would take our tablet for 6 months to a year. The density would go down. It would sort of reset the computer, so to speak. And we would prevent about half of the 250,000 cancers a year in the U.S., 2 million worldwide. So, that is my life's mission here at Atossa Therapeutics.
It's amazing. I was reading about the Evangeline study and endoxifen. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're doing some great things here. Is part of the reason that alcohol is an issue, if breast cancer is an endocrine, let's say, related disease, then you think of alcohol, which goes right to sugar in your system? Is that a piece of this?
Yeah. Very smart, Don. Very smart. So the two pieces for alcohol and breast cancer are, number one, it does increase estrogen. And so increased estrogen then drives increased cancer. It also increases inflammation. Inflammation is a foundation for cancers of almost any organ. So those two pieces of it, more estrogen and then more inflammation. In fact, with respect to lifestyle, exercising, where you get a little more testosterone, lowering your estrogen, lowering your if you're a little overweight, mm-hmm. the fatty tissues, tends to make estrogen. So anything you can do to lower your estrogen naturally is going to decrease your risk of breast cancer. And you can probably get about a 20% reduction from lifestyle changes, eating better, and getting some resistance training. So you're building muscle actually as a woman, and you're not going to get bulky if you're not taking testosterone. So, those things can be done without reverting to pharmaceuticals.
And Dr. Quay, I wanted to get to the fact that, you were a witness, an expert witness at that COVID hearing, what was that, last summer, and talking about COVID, the lab leak theory that we've heard a whole lot about, your testimony there, but as well your take on even the NIH study, which says that there needs to be more study done on COVID and its alleged or apparent link to COVID, those who are vaccinated with the mRNA, and then a possible link to things like Alzheimer's or cognitive decline. I mean, that's very concerning.
Yeah, I mean, we learned a lot, obviously, with COVID. And one of the things that we learned that is problematic is there's a very simple process where the spike of the virus attaches to fibrin, which is the starting formation of a clot. So, we have to have blood clots so we don't bleed to death. So that's the good part of having blood clots. But if you have too many, you can have a stroke, you can have a heart attack. And so the diabolical aspect of this virus is that it binds to fibrin. So fibrin is a nice smooth protein, and your blood is flowing past it, nothing's happening. Suddenly there are these little balls that are all spiky stuck to it. The platelets in the blood say, oh my gosh, this isn't good, and they start sticking there. Long story short, you make microclots in the heart, in all the tissues, so the kidneys, every organ, in your eyes, in your brain. And so we now know that the foundation of getting what's, was long COVID, which is, cognitive fog and all sorts of other kinds of month-long processes, is this slow microclotting process, and it feeds on itself, and it's hard to shut off. So knowing that, we can begin to think about how you would treat it, but it certainly is something that we've not seen before. It looks like it might be designed into the virus. There's some pretty diabolical things designed into this virus that are not good. It's quite.
And,
quite serious.
Well, when you say that, my question is this. Is it the virus? And I do want to get into the lab leak theory that it's not, you know, that it would appear. And we heard this early on, quite frankly, from medical voices, and perhaps you're one of them who said, this really doesn't look like something that just happened naturally. And that goes to the lab leak theory. So I wanted to get into that, because then my next question is, there are people who say, well, is this then, you know, dangerous for me, or a greater risk to get a quote unquote booster or the COVID mRNA vaccine? Or are we talking about the virus itself? Do you know what I'm saying? In other words,
yeah, I do. And it does get complicated there. So we're at a point where, I mean, I just did an analysis tonight, just before this call here, where the world, the WHO reports that we've had 1 billion people out of the 8 billion have been infected. But if you look at blood samples and see antibodies to the various parts of the protein that you have in an infection, it's 100%. So we've all had COVID. We all have some natural immunity to it. It's not as good as, you know, measles, where you get one shot and you're immune for your lifetime. But we are definitely at a point where there begins to be a trade-off between what might be more immunity from a vaccine or a booster, and the booster telling your body that this is part of you. There's a part of immunology, which is treating allergies, and the way they do that is they give you small amounts of the allergy over a very long period of time to basically trick your body into thinking, hey, this must be part of me because I'm seeing this all the time. It started out looking different than me. It's a foreign protein, mm-hmm. but now I'm seeing it all the time. And so there's a protein, there's an antibody change called IgG4, which tolerates proteins. So when you have allergies to things, the doctor will teach your immune system to tolerate that allergen. And that's great for hay fever and things like that. It's not good if your vaccine is teaching you to tolerate a virus. And so we are definitely in the zone above three shots where you have more IgG4 than you do of the standard one. And you're basically making yourself less able to fight it. I'm not practicing medicine on your radio station. This is right. Really important. So before you get a booster, tell your doctor about the IgG4, make him measure it. And if you have it, then the two of you have to look at each other and say, you know, you're at a point now where everything I do to you with a vaccine is making you tolerate this virus more. Maybe we should just back off and, take another mm-hmm. path.
Well, and that explains why, because I was, you know, we, to go back to work, and we were in, you know, I'm broadcasting live from Philadelphia. So here in Pennsylvania, we had, and in Philadelphia in particular, we had among the strictest, the toughest restrictions in the nation, and lasted a long time. So we actually had the convention center. I went down, the National Guard was this big guy, gives me the jab. I got the mRNA, I was Pfizer'd, as we say, but I did not get the booster. What I noticed was that relatives and friends and colleagues who've gotten every booster, every opportunity, they seem to be sick all the time. And even when they get COVID, because it just went through my house again over the Christmas break, I had it, but it was mild. Whereas my colleagues and friends and family who've been boosted they have it worse. Is that part of the...
You're ready to put your name on a diploma there, a medical diploma.
Not at all. Armchair, you know. But I mean, that, I guess with what you're saying, this is finally we get a medical explanation for why we're observing this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. You're building tolerance through what's called a class shift from good IgGs to IgG number 4, which is the tolerance antibody.
And so for you, as far as this lab leak theory, is there, in your professional and medical opinion, something I know you testified to, where do you lean on that as far as whether or not this was man-made, whether it got a little help to create this dirty little nasty little COVID virus?
So You know, I have tried to treat this as if it was in a court of law and making sure the evidence is very solid, because any conclusion I come to, you know, if I'm speaking in the Senate, you know, it can have implications for, it can have massive implications. And so the three levels in a court are 51% if you're fighting over money, so preponderance of the evidence, you got to have 51% more than the other person. If the state wants to take your children away from you, they got to get the clear and convincing, which is 75% evidence. And then the criminal is 95 or above. So we let people not become guilty if, you know, there's a 6% chance they didn't do it or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so using those criteria and then walking through the 26 different things that you can look at with this virus, you get well above 97%. So this virus came from a laboratory. So it didn't come from nature. It came from a laboratory. That's point number one at 97%. Number two is, was it a natural virus in the laboratory or was it manipulated? Again, 95% that it was manipulated. And then the aspects of it that are manipulated for benevolent, for malevolent reasons, like turning off the immune system and making it asymptomatic, is between, you know, 60 and 70%. So it was, came from a laboratory, it was manipulated in a laboratory, and it seems to have features that would not be academic research that I would do when I was teaching at Stanford, for example, with viruses in a lab, but have more sinister properties.
And part of that is, Doctor, and that's my question, is that my fear is that, in essence, with COVID, and you, I think, alluded to this, is that it's almost like the virus, depending on who you are and your makeup and all of that, it's like maybe a ticking, I don't want to say a ticking time bomb, but something that could be activated at some point. And have we not yet seen the full effects of the virus within each of us?
Dawn, again, you are spot on. There is a 4 to 5% phenomenon with this virus. You know, where we all sort of, I mean, in my daughter's school, you know, there's a 44-year-old business guy, you know, reasonable health, and he's killed by the virus. So there's 4 to 5% of cases which are just, to me, totally unexplainable. I struggle to find a foundation for these weird cases of extreme harm by this virus and people that it shouldn't do, you know, the athletes that are dropping dead in their 20s and that sort of thing. So that's still left on the table for me to figure out. But I mean, the rest of it, it's a relatively benign virus if you're not old or have comorbidities. So for people under 50 without any other problems, it's under 1% in terms of the, you know, 1% will die with it. And then between 50, you know, then it goes up. And then if you start having other, you know, cancers or immune problems, it goes up from there and that sort of thing. But even in that under 50, I'll give you an example, the 44-year-old father of a child at my daughter's school. He shouldn't have died. You know, so there is that aspect. If I find out, I will let the world know. It's you know, I have these post-its above my desk of things I don't understand about this virus, and there used to be 100, and they're now about 15. So it's one of the 15.
If I'm confessing, Dr. Quay, it's that I've spent way too much time at hospitals, including Children's Hospital Philadelphia, during the pandemic, and this was before the vaccine was available. My healthy teenage son, fit, healthy, worked out 6 days a week, did crew, all of that. Suddenly, with zero family history, took him to the ER. He was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. He's been part of studies. I'm talking to all of these endocrinologists all the time, as recently as last week. I'll be back again this Thursday. And they were, you know, talking about this. And this was, they see this huge spike in something that was rare, type 1 diabetes, diseases like that, autoimmune diseases, that they've seen this spike that they've not seen. And not just in America, worldwide.
Yeah, that's true. It's very unfortunately true that both autoimmune diseases in general, and myocarditis is certainly you know, well talked about issue with, especially again with the teenage and young men for some reason. It's very unfortunate.
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing.
Well, I just pray for answers and people like you who are transparent with it. And like you said, Dr. Quay, it's all about just making those risk reward informed choices and so on, talking to your, just being educated. So thank you, Dr. Stephen Quay. I hope you come back, just a brilliant medical mind and somebody who, you know, focuses on keeping us healthy and keeping us informed. Thank you, doctor.
I would love to. We love Philadelphia. My daughter just graduated from the law school there, so we're happy. City of love.
Oh, what, oh, which where can I, can you say where she graduated? Is it Temple?
She's at UPenn. She was at UPenn,
oh,
and now
gosh.
She's in New York City and starting her law career. So very exciting.
Penn Carey's a great school.
A doctor and a lawyer and the family. You're set. Thank you, Dr. Quay.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Dawn Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.